Let's do that.
So we'll see. Who's the protest on Sunday, huh?
It's not kosher.
What are they doing?
Nice. This is the next level.
I've been looking for a revolutionary cause to stand up for and champion.
What is this? That they're going to send draft dodgers to jail or something?
Dinner table neutral?
They were a lot. There was some glass waiting. I don't know where they're
right
now. Oh. I'm saying it's a thinner.
Oh, they might have actually swapped it.
Rolf, Tzadok of Lublin is the same as Rolf Tzadok of Koin?
Yeah.
Ah,
okay. Yeah. same as Rolf Tzadok Rabinowitz.
Was he actually a leader of a Hasidic group?
He was at the end of his life. Most of his life he was not. He didn't want to. He was a misnagid who became a chassid, and he was although he was the greatest Talmud Chacham of his group, but he was an Ishbitzer chassid. And the Meir Shiluach was his Rebbe. And then Rav Leibel Eger, Rav Kiveger's grandson, who became a chassid. That was a big scandal in Yale. And only when Rav Leibel Eger was nifter, he was the same age as Rav Tzedek, so he became a Rebbe the last 5 years. But Rav Tzedek had no children, so there was no continuity. But I don't know if Ishbitz even continued as a dynasty. I don't know if there's an Ishbitz or Rebbe today, though. But as a Baal Machshava, Rav Tzedek had a very profound impact, even within the literature Torah world, especially that. The two Hasidic Sfarim that are still very much studied by Balei Machshava, even if they're not Hasidim, are Shas Emes and Reb Tzadok. Those are the two. Hey, buddy. So we were looking at this idea about the four Parshios, Shkalim, Zachor, Chodesh, and Parah. Deal with three of the ways that we escape our enslavements. And we'll talk about the fourth one in a moment. That is, again, Pirkei Avos teaches us that there are three negative factors that take a person out of the world, and that is kina, jealousy, taiva is lust, and kavod, and desire for honor. They take a person out of this world, which means he loses his olam haba, and even his life in this world, it gets very miserable. So what we talked about at the end of yesterday was that the first parsha of the half shekel is the antidote towards the idea of jealousy. And the reason it helps us with jealousy is that the half shekel highlights the notion of equality, that every person has to give the same, because when it comes to the service of Hashem, every person stands before Hashem with equality of dignity. So even if one person can learn, let's say, 100 blot of Gemara a day, another person only do one daf of Gemara a day or less, as long as each person is serving Hashem with sincerity and doing the best they can, they stand before Hashem in equal value. So equality is a big antidote to jealousy, because after all, I might be jealous of somebody's greater accomplishments, but if I know that in Hashem's eyes I'm equal, as long as I'm doing my best, then there's nothing to be jealous about. If I'm not doing my best, then there's also nothing to be jealous about, because it's within my power to improve and become better. You know, the Mabit, who was a contemporary of Yosef Karo, Moshe ben Yosef Trani was their family name. So the Mabit says that this is the explanation of a Gemara. The Gemara says in Ksubas that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi had a son, and the son had what you might call a death experience, a near-death experience. He died, and his neshama went up to Gan Eden. And then when he was revived, he was asked to describe what did he see in the Garden of Eden. What did he see in Olam Haba, in Shemayim? So the son said, Olam Hapuch Ra'isi, I saw a topsy-turvy world. El Yonim, those who are high and mighty in this world, Lamata, we're at the bottom in the world to come, and Tachtonim, and those who are lowly and insignificant in this world, Lamala, we're at. And Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, you did not see a topsy-turvy world, you saw the true world. The true world, the El Yonim are going to be Lamata, and the Tachtonim are going to be Lamala. This is the Gemara. So the Mabit raises the question, what does Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's son mean by El Yonim and Tachtonim? If El Yonim just means rich, powerful people, so what's the Havamina? Why would you assume, just because somebody's rich and powerful in this world, that should count in Olam Haba? I mean, your money and your power doesn't mean anything there. So the Mabit says, an interesting point, the Mabit says, Elyonim, people who are high, does not refer to people who are high in Gashmias and materialism. But it actually means people who are high in spiritual attainments. But they weren't giving all of their... He gives an example. Let's say a person is a big, big Eloi, a big genius, and he's able to learn 100 blot of Gemara a day. Imagine that. Imagine learning 100 blot of Gemara a day. That means you could finish Sukkah in... a morning and afternoon Seder. You wouldn't even, you take off night Seder. 100 blot of Gemara a day. Most people don't do, even a daf a day. Daf yomi is a hard thing to do. So he learns, let's say, 30 blot of Gemara a day. Much more than anyone else. So he's only giving Hashem 30% of what he's able to do. And then somebody else struggles and does a few lines, but he's doing the best that he can. So in this world, we might superficially say, oh, the guy that does 30 blot is like a million times better than the other guy. So that's what the son is saying. In Olam Haba, those who seem to have attained greater spiritual attainments will actually be inferior, because Hashem literally judges us by the effort that we put forth. Now that's an amazing thing. You know, all teachers like to say, we judge our students by efforts. Well, it's a nice thing to say, but Lamaisa, the report card or the final or whatever it is not based on effort. It is based on what you tangibly accomplished. But in Ruchnius, it really is not that way. In Ruchnius, in spiritual matters, it is really how much effort you put forth that really is the credit. And that's what the Machzor Sashego teaches us. Two people. One is rich in spiritual attainments. The other is poor. But they're both equal if they're giving Hashem that same effort. Yeah.
I forgot what we said about the person who is on top in this world who maximizes their potential for Hashem.
Yeah.
How that relates to the analogy of the person being on the on top, on the bottom in the world.
No, that's what I was saying. In other words, the people, that's what he's saying. The people that we think are high on a spiritual level may in fact be lower in Hashem's judgment. Because we look at a person, what he accomplished. You can learn 100 pages a day, so you're up here. But in the world to come, you might be down here because you've only done 30% of what you're capable of doing. I mean, that's the analogy. In other words, the concept is that Elyonim, those who we think are so great in this world because of their spiritual... That's why there's a Havamina. To say that somebody's rich... is not necessarily going to be high in Olam Haba. That's obvious. There's no reason to assume that. Mm-hmm. But somebody who accomplished a lot in Torah, you would think gets more Olam Haba. But the answer is no. If his effort was defective, he will not get as much Olam Haba. Somebody who accomplished less but worked harder. This is a big. This should be a source of great chizuk, great encouragement. For people who say began learning late or whatever it is, because once again, even though in an objective sense it might be difficult to fully catch up, but that's not what Hashem is looking at. Hashem is looking at how much of our potential are we giving to His service. besides the fact, by the way, that you can indeed catch up. You know, I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure you know this, but Rav Schiller likes to have, he likes to show when he goes on fundraising trips. He often takes an extra suitcase, a heavy suitcase actually. The extra suitcase are all of the svarim that have been written by Or Sameach alumni, many of whom came from non-religious backgrounds. So it's like 50, well, you know, Rav Kanik is a Magid Shir, there's also a Talmud of Or Sameach. He, you know, he has written many svarim that guys use in the Beis Medrash. But not just Rav Kanik. I mean, they're basically like, many, many Talmidim of Or Sameach have written svarim that are used in yeshivas. Rav Schiller likes to show that as tangible evidence of accomplishment. So even in terms of catching up with the great Talmidei Chachamim, you know, you can certainly do that, but there's a deeper point that even if one is objectively not as great as somebody else who's been learning all of his life, that's not what Hashem is looking at. He's the one that's important in this final exam. Hashem is looking at how much of our effort are we giving to His service, how much of ourselves are we giving to Him, and that ultimately counts much more than whatever it is you objectively accomplish in the world. And that's the lesson of Machtus HaShekel. Rich and poor are potentially equal in their access to God, and therefore jealousy is a non-factor. There is no reason to be jealous, and therefore if we internalize the lesson of Machtus HaShekel, we can overcome the mida of kina, of jealousy. Now, I mentioned the other aspect of Machtus HaShekel, and that is interdependence, right? Why do you give a half shekel instead of a whole shekel? The answer is because a half is not complete unless it's combined with a whole. And therefore, the idea is every Jew needs every other Jew. It's not simply I do my thing, you do your thing, but rather my Avodas Hashem is not complete without you doing your Avaida as well. And the same way, therefore, that the most complicated spaceship or airplane needs the 30-cent screw. Without that screw, the whole thing could fall apart, as indeed sometimes happens. So, too, every person is needed. So that, too, is an antidote to jealousy. It prevents me from being inferior because I'm needed. It prevents someone else from being superior, looking down at me, because he needs me. Right? So in a sense, that interdependence creates a solidarity and a connection in which jealousy is successfully again. Now, I had just read an interesting bit of trivia in the Malay language, in Malaysia. It's actually fascinating. I don't know where they got this from. The first number, when they start counting numbers, is 2. 2 is tang. Tang. And 1 is seitang. Seitang means half of 2. Meaning they don't have a number called 1. They just have a number called half 2. Which means the basic units of significance is 2. Now, you might call that pagan, maybe if you care, maybe if you believe in one God, you do start with 1, I understand. But at least in human relationships, what it's saying is the significance of humanity lies in the union of 2, and 1 is only a fraction. That's why Chazal say, indeed, without making any single people feel bad, that's why Chazal say that a single person is half a person. Now, you have to make yourself the best half that you can, right? So the better half you are, the stronger the unit is going to be. But in reality, the meaning of being completely human lies in the relationship, right? And that, I don't know, maybe the Malays somehow caught on to that by tang and seitang. Okay. Yeah. So that's the first one. So that's how Shkolim helps us with the idea of jealousy. And that's an important idea of Achdus, of Avas Yisrael, and the like. Now, the next part, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but I want to complete the units, is Parshas Zohar. Now, Parshas Zohar is the story of Amalek. Now, once again, let me remind you, we're going to read it the Shabbos before Purim, and we're going to read the regular parts of the week, but there'll be a maftir about remembering Amalek, and then we'll have a Haftorah in the prophets about the biblical, the prophetic narrative when King Saul was commanded to kill Amalek. And, you know, Shmuel was the Navi. Shmuel commanded King Saul from Hashem to kill Amalek. And if you remember the story, Shaul HaMelech killed everybody. He did fulfill the mitzvah, but not completely. There were two things he left over. He left over the sheep in order to bring a sacrifice to God, so he says. And what's even worse, he spared the king. And when Shmuel confirmed, by the way, Shaul was one strike and you're out, by the way. In other words, because of that, Shaul lost his malchus, and the malchus was given to King David HaMelech. But if you recall, actually, let's talk about that a little bit, because we'll stretch this out into next week as well. So we have that story of Amalek, right? Now, what then happened was that, actually, it's a very poignant scene, because Shaul doesn't really know what went on here. Hashem comes to Shmuel first and says, "Why did Shaul not obey my commandment? I therefore despise him as king." The pasuk says, Shmuel prayed for Shaul the entire night. It's fascinating. We don't realize how much Shmuel cared for Shaul and how much Shmuel, because what happened basically is this. It's interesting that after praying for a whole night, and Hashem does not change his mind. So you see what an Eved Hashem Shmuel is. So Shmuel goes out with no touch, no tinge of sympathy. In other words, Shmuel talks to Shaul in a very, very tough way. And you get the impression that Shmuel doesn't care about Shaul anymore. In fact, the reader is privy to information that Shaul himself may not have had. That is, how desperately Shmuel begged, pleaded for Shaul. But when Hashem says no, Shmuel does his job with no compromise and no rachamim at that point, because that was the will of Hashem. In other words, it's not like Shmuel comes out. I mean, I found it very interesting. It's not like Shmuel comes out and said, "Well, I really wanted to help you, but you know, what can I tell you? God said no." That's not how you do it. If God says no, then that's what you do. You do it with full enthusiasm. You don't kind of say, "Well, you know, I would have preferred the other way, but what could I do?" That's not the way Shmuel is. Shmuel is absolutely nails here. He's tough as nails. Okay. Now, it's interesting that they ask Akasha, again, this is, I'm drifting away from the theme a little bit, but I will get back to it. They ask Akasha that how come Shaul only gets one strike and you're out? He does one Aveira, and this is it.
What is he doing again?
He is supposed to kill the nation of Amalek, and Shaul spares the king. Now, this had tragic ramifications, because Shmuel himself killed the king of Amalek pretty soon, right afterwards. But we are told, in that brief interlude between Shaul capturing the king and Shmuel killing the king, Agag was somehow able to impregnate an unknown woman, and that child was the ancestor of Haman, who hundreds of years later was the enemy of the Jewish people, almost destroyed us. So what looked like an act of mercy, what looked like an act of compassion, could have been responsible for the entire destruction of the Jewish people. And that is why, by the way, Mordechai and Esther are descendants of Shaul. They had the responsibility to cause the death of Haman, to finish, to rectify what Shaul failed to do. So Shaul loses his job, right? Basically, Shmuel is then told, go and anoint. I mean, Shaul hung around for a little bit longer, but essentially the next day, Shmuel was told to go anoint one of Yishai's sons, who turned out to be David HaMelech. So Shaul gets what you call one strike and you're out, right? One strike and he's out. Now David HaMelech, later, seem to have done sins that are much worse than this. Shaul's sin was a sin of omission. He didn't do something he was supposed to do. David, if you remember, this is the whole story, that David was very confident that he had purified himself, and David says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, "I am pure, I am righteous. Give me a test, you see how righteous I am." So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "You're not supposed to be so confident in yourself." And what he does is, he shows David a beautiful woman who is bathing on top of a roof, and she thinks nobody sees her. But David sees her. Like the Gemara's old story, she actually had a mechitza around her, and he caused the mechitza to collapse that way. And David is attracted to her. But the problem is, of course, she's a married woman. So what does David do? David sends her husband, Uriah, to the front. And Uriah gets killed in battle. And then David can marry this widow. By the way, the implication of the narrative also is that David slept with her before, even before that happened. Okay, we'll discuss it. Now the Maaseh, the Gemara says, so number one, so what is David guilty of here? I mean, this, if you just read the Psukim before Chazal's brother. So number one, David is guilty of adultery. Well, kina, of course, but that's a midah. But in terms of technical averus, David is guilty of adultery.
Murder.
He might possibly be guilty of rape, but even if we say it wasn't rape, and even if she consented, it would be adultery. Number two, he's guilty of indirect murder because he deliberately puts the soldier in harm's way. And bichlal, it's a very, very deceptive thing. The whole thing is a very sordid business. Because what actually happens is, after he slept with her, she got pregnant. And David didn't want to be exposed as causing the pregnancy. So listen to this story. Uriah was already in the army. He ordered Uriah to come back on leave to be with his wife so that David could deny the paternity of the child and say it was Uriah's child. This is before they had DNA and blood tests.
Smart guy.
Uriah was such a loyal soldier, though, that he didn't want to come home. Right, so now you have a real problem, because now it's going to turn out that everyone's going to know or figure out that the David HaMelech impregnated her. So David went to plan B, in which he told his general Yoav, put him in the most dangerous combat position so he'll get killed, and that way I can marry her, so when she has a child, people aren't going to count 9 months backwards, and they'll figure it out. So it's more than, it's not just the adultery and even the murder, it's also the whole idea of wanting to deny, he would have denied, had Uriah come home, David would have denied his paternity to the child. He would have passed it off as Uriah's child and the like. Although you might always have a problem, we don't really know if the child looked like David or whatever. It's similar to, well, okay, whatever it is. In Arnold Schwarzenegger's office, or whatever it is, his clean lady had a child who looked exactly like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he denied paternity, like, for 13 years, that's what David Arnold is going to do. Now, first of all, I just want to tell you the story as it's recorded in Tanakh, then we'll go over what the Gemara says about it. Now, Shmuel HaNavi was already dead. Shmuel HaNavi died before David even became king. Right? Shmuel died early. But the prophet that is the main Navi is Nathan HaNavi, Nathan the prophet. And Nathan goes over to David, and it's a very powerful narrative. And Nathan tells David, King, I have a question to ask you. I want you to judge. There was a rich man and a poor man. And the rich man had sheep and all sorts of property, and the poor man had one little lamb that was his, like a pet, it was his prized possession. He loved it, and he fondled it, and he took care of it. And the rich man had to make a banquet, and the rich man didn't want to take his own stuff, so he took the poor man's one little lamb, all that this poor man had in the world, and he shechted it, and he served it, and he ate it. What should be done to such a man? So David HaMelech said, such a man is wretched and selfish and stingy and cruel, and such a man deserves to die, at least in a spiritual sense. He's a wretch who doesn't deserve life. Nathan HaNavi then points to the king and says, you are that man. You had everything. You have, David had many wives. You have wealth, you have power, you're a king. And this soldier, all he had in the world was his wife. You took it from him. You are that man. And David acknowledged his sin. And of course, but going back to my question, and that is, David did suffer tremendously because of this chait. In fact, the child that Bathsheba was carrying was stillborn. And of course, all of the tzaris David had, if you learn the book of Shmuel, towards the end of his life, he had the rebellion of Avshalom, his own son wanted to depose him and kill him. And, Amnon and Tamar, in which one of his sons raped his half-sister. Many, many, many different tzaris. And this was an onesh, but the one thing that didn't happen to David is David was not deposed, and the Davidic line continued. Not only that, but it continued precisely through the sinful marriage with Bathsheba, because Shlomo HaMelech was the next son of Bathsheba, right? So it's interesting that not only did David not get deposed, but the Malchus based David came through Bathsheba. In fact, by the way, you know, the last chapter of Proverbs is the very, very famous song that we sing Friday night, Eshes Chayil, a woman of valor who can find. So it was written by King Solomon, who wrote the book of Proverbs, but many commentaries say he wasn't writing it about any of his wives, because Shlomo HaMelech's wives were not so great. He was actually writing it as a praise of his mother, Bathsheba. The Eshes Chayil, the woman of valor, was none other than Bathsheba. So the question becomes, how come David gets another chance at this? I mean, David's Malchus continues, and Shaul HaMelech, who fails to kill Amalek, he's totally finished. Now, Lemaisa, the Gemara does mitigate. The Gemara does mitigate significantly the actual chait of David HaMelech. The Gemara, in fact, says in Masechet Shabbos that anybody that says that David actually sinned is making a mistake. Why? Because in David HaMelech's army, there was a universal practice that every soldier who went to war gave a get to his wife. Why would a soldier give a get to his wife? For a real problem. Because if, God forbid, a soldier is missing in action, and we don't know if he's dead or alive, his wife would never be able to marry. That's a situation that happens even in Israel today. It's an aguna. That's correct. That's correct.
Does that also apply to Kohanim? They also divorce their wives?
Well, Kohanim might be a different story. Kohanim might do it through a conditional divorce. Which means if I don't show up in 5 years, you know, you could remarry. In other words, the get is chal. But a Yisrael would actually give an absolute divorce and they just remarry.
Do religious soldiers now do that?
Well, there was a proposal, you know, some do it privately, some people do it privately, but institutionally they don't encourage it, but there was a proposal in the early 50s to the Rabbanut, because, you know, Jews were taken hostages and there were prisoners of war, that every soldier give a get to his wife. It was decided not to institute it on a wide scale, because it might be detrimental to combat morale. Because a lot of combat morale is, my wife is waiting for me. Because once she has a get, she's free to marry somebody else. So it would seem that it would weaken a soldier's resolve if his wife would be free to marry somebody else. So they decided not to mandate or encourage it. But privately, there are people who do it. There are religious soldiers who actually do this when they go into battle. So their wives should not be agunot. Their wives should not be stranded women. So technically, therefore, David HaMelech did not commit adultery with Bathsheba because she was a divorced woman. Technically, he also didn't commit murder. Number one, he didn't murder him. He just assigned him in a to a combat position. But number two, the Gemara indicates that Uriah was actually Chayev Misa. Why? Because David gave him a direct order to come home, and he defied the direct order of the king. If you defy the order of a king, you could be executed. So, technically, David HaMelech had his cards lined up. No, there was no issue of adultery, because Uriah had a get, and there was no issue of getting him killed, because Uriah defied the king's orders. That's fine. But at the same time, it's impossible. See, some people, I don't know why people do this, because it's absolutely not. Some people say, therefore, David HaMelech did nothing wrong. If the Gemara says David didn't sin, David HaMelech did nothing wrong. That doesn't make sense. Of course David HaMelech did something wrong. That's what Nathan the prophet is telling him. That's why the baby died, and that's why David had Avshalom. So when the Gemara says anybody who says David sinned is making a mistake, the Gemara doesn't mean it's a mistake to say that David sinned. It means it's a mistake to say that David committed the sin of adultery and murder. That he didn't do, but he certainly, certainly sinned. And the sin was that even though she was technically a divorced woman, but the understanding was she would normally wait for her husband. So it's a spiritual type of adultery. Yes, and with respect to the murder, the same thing. Yes, Uriah was chayav Nisa. What does it mean? Well, it means that I'll give you an example. If a woman is about to marry a man, and I convince her to go with me, that's not adultery because she's not married to him yet, but it's spiritual adultery because her loyalties were already connected to a particular person. So something can be adultery in spirit, even if it's not adultery by the letter of the law. Murder is the same thing. Did Uriah deserve to die? Well, he did deserve to die because he defied a direct order. But let's look at the direct order. Why did David give him that direct order? Because David wanted to cover up. So giving the order itself emanated from an improper motivation. So David HaMelech's sin was quite severe, at least for his level, because the greater the righteous person, the more accountable he is. So let's go back to my question. So my question now becomes, okay, so let's go back to square one, and that is, how come Shaul's sin of not killing HaMelech gets no forgiveness? And David's sin, which approaches adultery and murder, God forgives, right? Why does David get an easier break than Shaul? Yeah.
Does the fact that David asked, King David asked for it, in some way negate the severity of his sin? Because it's as if he brought it upon himself, and Hashem knew he would fail to begin with. So Hashem wasn't really giving him the task. It was David kind of setting himself up to lose.
Well, that is an interesting difference. The question is whether that makes it better or makes it worse. You know, one could make the argument that if you're asking for this, then it's even worse because you're inviting yourself to.
It's as if he shouldn't have been there to begin with, whereas with Shmuel, he was told to be there.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. That's an interesting answer. In other words, you're basically saying that David's situation was not a God-mandated Nisayan. It was like David's own predicament. So as a result, if he messed up, it's like he messed up on a project he volunteered for.
Yeah.
So you're suggesting maybe that if you mess up on a volunteer project, it's not as bad as when you mess up as when you're given up to do.
Yeah.
That's an interesting distinction. That might be so. But let me give you three other terutzim. Two terutzim, two answers, are given by Rav Yosef Albo. Rav Yosef Albo was a great medieval philosopher in the 1400s, who wrote a sefer called, he was in Spain, the sefer is called Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Fundamentals. It's a great work of medieval philosophy. In fact, his main thesis, by the way, is he differs with the Rambam. The Rambam maintains there are 13 principles. 13 fundamental principles of Jewish faith. Rav Albo argued there's only 3 principles. And he differentiated between what are called root principles, Ikarim are roots, or Sharashim, versus Anafim, which are called branch principles. And he said there are 3 roots out of which many branches come, but the branches are not equal to the roots. According to the Rambam, all 13 are equal. Rav Albo says there's only 3 that are the roots. The 3 are, number 1, the existence of God, who created heaven and earth. Number 2, God rewards goodness and punishes evil, either in this world or the world to come. And number 3, God revealed what is evil by the giving of the Torah. Now, what Rav Albo is basically saying is, things like Mashiach, Olam Haba, resurrection of the dead, which Maimonides counts as fundamental principles, he says they are simply details in what form the reward and punishment is going to take. So a practical difference is this. Let's say a person didn't believe in physical resurrection of the dead. Let's say a person took the position that the soul is eternal, but the body doesn't come back. Maimonides would call that person an apikoros, a heretic, and a kofar, because he is denying the 13th principle. Rav Alba would say, as long as you believe that there is an ultimate reward and punishment, whether it's this thing or that thing, does not make you an apikoros. Now again, people misunderstand Rav Alba. Rav Alba is not disagreeing with the Rambam on what is true. In other words, people say, oh, does Rav Alba deny physical resurrection? No. This is important to understand. Rav Alba also believes in physical resurrection. But he's saying, if you don't believe, you are a mistaken person. But a mistaken person is not a heretical person. You see the important difference. To Maimonides, if one does not believe in physical resurrection, they are a heretic. They are an apikoros. According to Rav Alba, they are simply mistaken. Now, if one, however, did not believe in reward or punishment, says once we're dead and that's it, that would be a heretical belief, even according to Rav Alba. But be it as it may, Sefer Ikarim is actually a very, well, I don't want to say easy, the books are not easy, but it's a much easier book than The Guide to the Perplexed. And he often has interesting digressions on biblical interpretation. So in one of his digressions, he actually asks this question, why is it that the David HaMelech gets forgiven and Shaul doesn't get forgiven, right? This is a question. So he gives two interesting answers. One answer is that Shaul HaMelech failed in carrying out the duties of his position. He was a king. As king, he was commanded to eradicate Amalek. He failed to fulfill the obligations of his position, so he was removed from office. David HaMelech's sin was a personal Yetzer Hara. He had a desire for a woman, etc., but he did not fail in the execution of his position. So the Sefer says an interesting thing, that there's a difference between failing in your position responsibilities versus a personal moral failure. A personal moral failure does not necessarily disqualify you. Now, Lahavdil, this had actually a contemporary resonance. I don't know if you remember Bill Clinton's presidency and the like. This was actually the issue that arose in Clinton's situation, in which he did personal things that were not moral. But the argument is, hey, what you do as a person does not affect what you do as a president. Now, that's putting aside the fact that there was lying under oath and various other things. And indeed, you know, the Constitution says, the United States says, Israel doesn't have a written constitution, but in the Constitution of the U.S. says that a president may be impeached. And the phrase in the Constitution is high crimes and misdemeanors. So that's a vague phrase, obviously. But there are some commentators that say a president can be impeached only for misconduct in the performance of his official duties, like bribery. But if a president goes to a bar Saturday night and, you know, kills somebody with a baseball bat, that has nothing to do with being a president, and he can be impeached. He can go to jail, he can be arrested to go to jail, but he can still be president. You cannot remove him from office because of personal crimes. It's a very interesting distinction. And that is, there's a chiluk between the abusive behavior because you're president and abusive behavior as a general human being. Now, we would normally think, Rav Alba's Teretz is a big chiddush, that, well, maybe that's relevant in a secular level, but it's certainly not relevant in a divine Torah position like Melech. And yet you find, Rav Alba says, that Shaul's Aveira was in his Malchus, and therefore he gets removed. David's Aveira was in his personal misconduct. Now, the Teretz is also a little schwer, because even if we say that David's adultery, or, you know, quasi-adultery, was a personal failure, but on the other hand, reassigning Uriah to combat, that that was something he did only because he was king. Had he not been king, he wouldn't have been able to do that. So I could call that abuse in the conduct of his office. Okay. But Rav Avogadro gives a second teretz that I think is a more powerful teretz and more relevant to us. And Rav Avogadro says the following. The difference between David and Shaul was not in the magnitude of their sin. Maybe David's sin was even worse. But the difference is how they respond when they're confronted with evidence of their guilt. And here you have to know the Haftorah. If you look at the story, when Shmuel said, when Shmuel comes out after Shmuel prayed the whole night and God says, sorry, he doesn't get a second chance. So Shmuel comes out and Shaul is so proud that he fulfilled the mitzvah, you know, 99%. And he says, I have done everything God has said. And Shmuel says, why do I hear the bleating of the sheep? So Shaul does a bunch of things. He first denies it. I've done everything. And when he can't deny it, he starts blaming other people. Well, the people wanted it and I was afraid of them and I listened to them. So Shaul, when he's confronted with his guilt, first tries to deny it, and secondly, then tries to evade responsibility by passing the buck and blaming others. David HaMelech, after Nasan HaNavi gives him the parable of the rich man and the poor man, and after David HaMelech says, such a person deserves to die, and Nasan says to David, you are the man. The book of Shmuel records David HaMelech's response. And it's quite amazing. David HaMelech has only one word, response. Chatasi. I have sinned. All of the excuses that the rabbis of the Gemara give him, he doesn't use. He could have said all of that. He could have said, she got a get. He could have said he denied an order, he defied an order and was chayav misa. That's what the Gemara gives him the ammunition. But he knew what he did was morally wrong. He knew that the motives were not proper. He did not equivocate. He did not deny responsibility. The Sefer Yikarim says, a leader can still be a leader even if he sins, if he takes the responsibility of doing tshuva and does not try to look for excuses. And therefore the nafkamina between David and Shaul was not in their sin, but in their taking of responsibility. And in this sense, we should point out the obvious connection that David was following the midah of his ancestor, Yehuda. Because with Yehuda and Tamar, right, Yehuda commits... has sexual relations with his daughter-in-law Tamar, not knowing it's his daughter. He thinks it's a prostitute. And when his daughter-in-law gets pregnant, and she's supposed to be waiting Yibam, so she is put on trial for her life, because Yehuda thinks she was promiscuous, she committed adultery. And she is not going to reveal his identity. She took his money belt and staff as a security for payment. And she just says to him, the man who gave me this is who made me pregnant. And if he would not have confessed up, she would have gone to her death in a fiery furnace. As the Gemara says, it is better to go to your death in fire than to embarrass somebody publicly. But what did Yehuda say? Yehuda said, she is more righteous than me. He offers no excuses. He doesn't try to deny things. He doesn't try to blame. And although David HaMelech initially was in that denial modality, indeed, that was his failure, but once he's confronted with his sin, he assumes full responsibility. And that is why the Malchus continued, because Malchus goes to people, Malchus in particular, goes to people who take responsibility for their actions and for their decisions. Mm. You know, they say that the sign of a bad executive is he takes credit for everything that's positive, and he blames other people for everything that's negative. But in reality, a manik has to take the achrayas, the responsibility, for the bad. So that's up. Now, okay, we'll segue. Next, we'll continue with, again, we have not, all of this is background. We have not come to the main thing that we're still talking about, and that is, how is Parshas Zohar an antidote for taiva, for lust? Okay, that's our theme. Today we didn't talk about that. We just filled you in about some of the details of Parshas Zohar. Okay, you have a good Shabbos.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
There's something that you said about